It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. We've got a very big show for you. We're bringing back one of our favorite guys for many years, the host of MacBreak Weekly, Scott Bourne, will help celebrate the 10th anniversary of the iPhone today. Ian Thompson's here from The Register. From This Week in Law, Denise Howell and Katie Benner, New York Times writer, will join us at the beginning of the show to talk about her article. It's sending shockwaves throughout Silicon Valley. It's all coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 621, recorded Sunday, July 2nd, 2017. Butler in a Box. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Carbonite. Keep your business safe this year. Protect your business from ransomware and hacker attacks with automatic cloud backup from Carbonite. Try it free at Carbonite.com. Use the offer code TWIT to get 2 free bonus months if you decide to buy. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your house. Go to ring.com/TWIT. And get up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit. And by WordPress. WordPress powers 28% of all websites, including my own. Get 15% off your new website at wordpress.com/twit. That's wordpress.com/twit. And literally by Sonic, TWIT's 10 gigabit fiber internet service provider. Join Sonic's internet revolution as they bring fast, affordable internet, phone, and TV to homes and businesses all over California. Visit sonic.com/twit to sign up for service and receive your first month free. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the great, late great tech news with some of the best tech journalists in the country, in the world sometimes. Ian Thompson is here from theregister.co.uk. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure too, Liam. Always have fun up here.
Thanks for coming in, firing up his Chromebook.
Yep.
He still believes he can get real work done on a Chromebook.
I can, although, you know, without an internet connection, it used to be a very expensive doorstop. Now it's not so bad.
I like it. I'm kind of jealous you still have a Pixel. I gave mine away. Also with us, and I'm really thrilled to welcome him back, he was a longtime host on MacBreak Weekly. We remember very well his iPhone vest. Here we are on the 10th anniversary of the iPhone, welcoming Scott Bourne back to the microphone. He says, still not dead is his poster. Hi, Scott. It's great to see
you.
Hey.
It's fantastic to be back on, Leo. Thank you. This is only my second time on the big show.
I can't believe that. Photo.
I know, like 150 MacBreak Weeklies, but only the second time on TWiT.
Well, I feel bad about that. I apologize.
Me too.
You still podcast like crazy at photopodcasts.com. And yep, I know you still take amazing wildlife pictures, and we could see a lot of those on your Instagram, and I see them on Facebook. Also joining us right now, Denise Howell from This Week in Law. We thought we kind of rejiggered the show a little bit to get a woman on the show. Thank you, Denise, for being here. And I'll tell you why we thought it'd be good to have a woman. Big news roiling Silicon Valley right now. It started with stories from The Information talking about Justin Kaldbeck, who is a venture capitalist. Started his own firm, Binary Capital, and has been accused by a number of women of inappropriate behavior. These were VCs who had approached him about funding. And Kaldbeck has now left the company. In fact, they're folding the venture fund. But then Katie Benner in the New York Times, just a couple of days ago, publishes an article which goes much farther, mentioning not only Kaldbeck, but other high-profile venture capitalists. Chris Sacca of Lowercase Capital, Dave McClure of 500 Startups. Dave wrote a mea culpa in which he said, I'm a jerk, and he'd planned to step down, but he'd stepped down a little early from his 500 Startups. This is roiling Silicon Valley. Katie Benner is on the line with us. We appreciate your joining us, Katie, from your first day off.
Okay.
I apologize.
Happy vacation.
Happy vacation. But you know, when you write a story that is this big, you know you're going to get calls. And I know you're doing interviews around it. How did this story come to you?
Well, so a lot of it, to your point, really did come after the information published the story about Justin Caldbeck. I think that most of the women in the story were not expecting the sort of support that they got. The story said that Justin Caldbeck had sexually harassed them or groped them or propositioned them while they were trying to raise money from his venture firm. So he was really in a position of power over them. They need the money for their companies to grow and survive. That's why you raise venture capital. It's why you make relationships and create friendships with VCs. And it's, you know, sort of what, it's the lifeblood of all of the innovation that Silicon Valley professes to embrace and to promote. So they were trying to raise money, they were harassed, and they didn't think anybody would believe them. And then not only did people believe them, you had Reid Hoffman and you had Melinda Gates come out on Twitter saying these women should be believed and they should be supported. So that was an extraordinary moment. And in the wake of that, you know, as I was calling people just to see what kind of impact the story was happening, I was meeting more and more women who said, you know, I want to go on the record too.
Wow.
I have a story to tell. And a lot of them had screenshots, text messages, Facebook messages supporting their allegations. You know, this wasn't he said, she said. We were reading these text messages saying, this is a real proposition. This is a really bad thing to do. So certainly a lot of people had that kind of supporting evidence as well that I think helped them come forward.
And of course, this follows on the heels of the Travis Kalanick's resignation from Uber, Susan Fowler's blog post, which started that. It is starting to feel like this is endemic in the Valley. Is that the sense you get, Katie?
Yeah, and I don't think that it's surprising to me that it would be so pervasive. If you think about it, the venture capital world is very tiny and very closed off. So, you know, it's very much a who you know sort of business. It's a network business. The actual capital itself is held firmly in the hands of these 100 or so venture firms, and there's no transparency, so they're not publicly traded. There's no reason for them to explain when bad things happen. So what usually happens is if a VC abuses his power, the firm is incentivized to let him or her go quietly, maybe pay them off, maybe put money into the next fund just to get them out of the firm's hair. And instead of letting everybody know why they're being fired or why there's a mutual agreement legally for them to part ways, they just let them go very quietly into the night, and then they can do whatever they want as long as they're not messing with the reputation of venture firm A or venture firm B. Those firms just push the people out and move them along. The way it was described to me was it's very similar to what the Catholic Church was doing when they'd find out that there were bad priests. They would just move them to another parish.
Right. Yeah.
Rather than say something bad had happened because that would hurt the reputation of the industry in a bigger way, just move them away and make them someone else's problem.
Well, and you point out in your article that 2 years ago, Alan Pau sued Kleiner Perkins and lost in a very kind of similar situation, which makes me feel like, and of course, we just saw, you know, Roger Ailes forced out at Fox News.
Bill O'Reilly as well.
O'Reilly. You get the feeling that where in the corridors of power, men have kind of started to run wild in a way that maybe they always have? Or do you think there's something, it's gotten worse?
I think that they always have, but we're seeing more women take on more positions of power, and more women feel like it's okay. There's no backlash that can happen that's going to keep them from speaking out. Now, that feels very new to me. I can't remember. I think that even 2 years ago when Ellen Pau took Kleiner to trial, it was extraordinary, and everybody said, I can't believe she did that. She'll never work again. It's going to destroy her career. Mm-hmm. Nobody said, this is going to hurt Kleiner, or what about Kleiner? Everybody said, oh my gosh, this woman just sacrificed herself. So now there's something has happened in the culture and in the zeitgeist where when people come forward, it's less about these women have just destroyed their careers and their potential to make money, and more about, oh, well, what happened and why is this happening? And do we want to do business with this firm? So there's a shift in the conversation that's important.
Last night, Dave McClure published I have to commend him for at least not denying saying, I did it. He says, I'm a creep. I'm sorry. He says he's seeking treatment. My behavior was inexcusable and wrong. credit to Dave for, I mean, not for what he did, but for immediately copping to it and stepping down. Mm-hmm. There are others you mentioned.
Keep in mind,
go ahead.
500 startups he had out stepped down months ago, and they just kept
right.
it quiet.
Right.
Once the story came out, there was no way for them to keep it quiet anymore, and they had to disclose.
Christine Tsai, his co-founder, is running the company. Did you get the sense Christine knew about this and had helped cover it up, or was she shocked?
I get the sense she was very surprised.
Yeah.
You know, the woman who we talked about in our story, she was harassed by Dave years ago, and it wasn't until... you know, way led on to way, and Christine heard about it and reached out to her just last year and said, I want to know more. Now, what happened after that is 500 Startups did launch an internal investigation, and in the past few months has forced Dave to step down. But you have to wonder, would they have ever been public about it
right.
and made that public knowledge without the story? Who knows? And if they hadn't, well, then doesn't that just perpetuate the problem? Because, you know, 500 Startups is known for supporting women. It's known for diversity initiatives. And if everybody still thinks Dave is a hero, well, then they're still going to do business with him, and he'll still be able to be in situations where women could be vulnerable around him because nobody knows he's done anything wrong.
I think one of the reasons this rocks Silicon Valley is because Chris Sacca and Dave McClure are well-liked and well-known in Silicon Valley, and it's... I think it's a bit of a surprise.
Well, I think also the tech industry always thought that it was above this sort of thing. We were
smarter, more enlightened.
We came into the 70s and 80s. A lot of the people who were the founding industries, but founding starters of the computing industry were geeks at school who got beaten up and are therefore slightly more open-minded about things. But it does seem from the stories that you and others have done on this is that we've got a serious problem which needs to be addressed. And the quite frankly, weasel words coming out of Binary Capital at the start of the week compared to where they are now was just...
They denied it at first.
Oh, initially, it was a flat-on denial, they're making this up. And now it's just, within 24 hours, it's kind of like, oh, this is the worst 24 hours of my life. It's like, well, boo-hoo. You know?
Katie, has there been any backlash to this article?
I mean, of course, there will always be backlash. Some of it I don't want to get too into because it's fairly... distasteful, but I think that the backlash that we've gotten does feel to me more interesting. I've gotten a lot of messages from people saying, okay, one, this you've focused on men harassing women, but please know that men harass men, and that this, you know, that it's not just sort of heterosexual men harassing women, that there is all sorts of harassment because there's such an imbalance of power between the people who have money and the people who need money technology to make ideas happen. So I think actually that's a very valid criticism.
Absolutely.
And also people talk about the fact that the harassment isn't standalone. The fact that it's sexual harassment or propositioning people for sex or trying to get them to go to bed with them, that's just a symptom of a larger problem in the industry, that women just aren't as respected.
Right.
And that if women were respected, that when those things happen, when that very specific harassment happens, people would be up in arms about it, sort of covering it up. So I thought that was an interesting perspective as well.
Katie, I know you're on vacation. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. I encourage people to read the article. Also read Albergati's article in the information, and we'll continue.
Reed's article is just excellent. So yes, definitely read that too.
Thank you, Katie. Enjoy your vacation.
Thank you. All have right. a great fourth.
Take care. Katie Bye. Benner, New York Times. Her article appeared in the June 30th online edition of the New York Times, and I probably is in print this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
While it feels like this is a breaking story, I also feel like this might be something that's been going on for a long time. Denise Howell, you've been covering technology for a very long time, at least 10 years. When did you started your blog many years ago? Have you seen... Go ahead.
I started my blog in 2001.
Okay.
You and Scott met in person for the first time in 2006.
I remember that.
At Podcast Expo.
Yeah, I remember.
And so my question is this something that's been going on all along but has been kind of a open secret, or is this something that has gotten worse over the last couple of years, this kind of harassment?
I feel like it's something that's been going on all along, and that it's not unique to the tech industry, that it's been going on in the legal industry and the banking industry and the farming industry and the journalism industry and all frontiers of science. And, you know, I mean, to think that harassment is unique to the tech industry is naive, because having been around the fringes of the tech industry, all of the harassment I have experienced has been outside of it. And I have experienced my share of it.
I'm sure you have. This is kind of the point. Every woman has a story to tell something like this. But you're right, Ian. We thought we were immune.
Well, I think we
know better. We're more modern.
Well, technology is supposed to be a meritocracy. It's a very young industry. It came in the 70s and 80s when we were supposed to have sorted a lot of this stuff out. And it's just very dispiriting when you see this stuff coming up again and again and again. But at least people are speaking out about it, and that does seem to be bringing around some change. And the more people that speak out about it, the better.
Will it help, Denise, to have more women in technology, more women in the boardroom, more women entrepreneurs, more women executives?
Absolutely. More women, to steal a phrase from Hamilton, in the room where it happens.
Yeah.
And to get to that point a little deeper, I am so grateful for Katie's reporting and the fact that we're having this conversation on the one hand, and by no means do I want people to discount what has been reported and alleged. But at the same time, there is some fallout from this, I think, that is damaging and productive, if I can say that. On the one hand, I think it's really important that we have these conversations. Reid Hoffman is absolutely right that his decency pledge, I hope people will go and read that and take it to heart, because I think that's how we get through this, that people live being decent. And fortunately, the vast majority of my relationships in the technology and in other business arenas have been where people lived being decent. But, you know, there are those episodes where you have, you know, you remember the terrible and traumatic things that happened to you. And I'm hoping for a day when people don't get to the middle or later part of their careers and look back and say, God, you know, I had tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of business relationships with people that went really, really well. And there was not a shred of harassment involved. But there are four or five that really stand out as being creepy and awful. And, you know, I hope we're moving away from that. And I think that the way that we get there is through what Reid Hoffman suggests. You know, you've got to, if you see something, say something. You've got to make sure that people who are doing this, and I do feel that they are in the minority of people in the business world, that there are still people out there today who haven't gotten the memo that this is just not okay. But if they're held accountable and if people are living this in their daily life, and if the checks on it aren't just the corporate message of, oh, we have legal compliance obligations where you have to go to a management training class and learn about harassment, and maybe someone's queuing up a video on a screen and letting it play and not really paying attention or even watching, and everyone's just checking a box that this has been done. But people are really living this in their daily lives, then I think we'll get to that point where everyone can be in the room where it happens. Because on the other end of this extreme of having this conversation, you were talking about backlash, Leo. One possible backlash, and one backlash that we already see in Washington, D.C., among congresspeople anxious to avoid scandal, senators as well, is sort of taking the Mike Pence approach where, oh, if you are of the gender where I might be associated with having a relationship with you, then you and I shall not have certain relationships that could be problematic and controversial. You and I shall not even dine together unaccompanied We will not be in a venue where there's alcohol served because of the fear of scandal and maybe false accusations. So I think on the other end of this extreme, you have to be really careful both that people who might be subject to harassment don't live in fear of that, and that people who might be accused of it don't live in fear of the false accusation. And not to have any sort of backlash to Katie's reporting, but just a bit of pushback. Two of the people that she reported on do dispute these allegations. She's saying that this is cut and dried and it happened based on the reporting that she's done and what she's seen. And she's certainly doing a service in reporting that. But two of the people here do dispute that this actually happened. Chris Sacca and Mark Cantor say, no, it did not go down like that.
Right. Yeah.
So we're having sort of a trial in the media for them. And I want, you know, people should be aware that this is not a trial in a court where credibility and witnesses and evidence are all subject to being.
It's tested. Challenging because, of course, one of the mantras is believe the woman. Right. Mm-hmm. But it is conceivable of that there's false accusations. And so it's very challenging. Yet, on the one hand, you don't want to dismiss these. But on the other hand, you don't want to convict somebody unreasonably. You're right. This is a survey from Claire Kane Miller in the New York Times. The upshot: Americans are wary of being alone with the opposite sex. And I think you're right. I think that would be a very bad trend because it would keep women out of the room where it happens.
This is it. I mean, when Mike Pence first made his comments about he wouldn't have lunch with a, you know, alone with a woman.
I understand why.
Well, I don't know, because I was kind of, part of me when I first read that was like, well, hang on. Is he saying that he's not sure he can keep control of himself?
No, I think he wants to be above suspicion.
Right. Okay.
And if you're a public figure, you might want to avoid these kinds of accusations.
It's also a very handy way, though, to make sure that, yeah, as you say, you can exclude women based on, I don't feel comfortable being in a room with you.
It's called the Billy Graham rule.
Yeah. That's the thing in New Yorker. He was on his deathbed. He wasn't alone with a female nurse. And you're like,
yeah. Now you wonder. I mean, I don't know what Billy Graham was worried about. I don't know what Mike Pence is worried about. I should point out, though, you were talking about diversity in tech, and Google's diversity report came out. Its annual diversity report. Mm-hmm. And while you do see more women at Google, it's still a fraction of what would nominally be 50 or 51%. Mm-hmm. It's only 31% of the total. Hires and only 20% of the tech hires.
Yeah.
The thing, though, that's very depressing to me is if you look at the diversity report, African Americans represent 2% of the overall, 1% of the tech hires, Hispanic people, 3% of the tech people. It is far from a diverse group. It is very heavily white and male.
I know, the Hacker Manifesto tended to get that one wrong, I think. The idea was we would all be brought together by technology.
Yeah, we feel like Silicon Valley should be a meritocracy.
Yeah.
Pure and simple, and it should be race blind, gender blind, but it clearly isn't.
Unfortunately, human beings work there, and they've all got their grab bag of prejudices and you know, mistaken views. So we're getting there, slowly but surely, but it's just not moving anywhere fast enough as fast as it needs to be.
So I agree with you, Denise. Reid Hoffman, who is the founder of LinkedIn, almost immediately after the information report a week ago Friday, published an article called "The Human Rights of Women Entrepreneurs" and asked people, you know, said we do care. We men in Silicon Valley, we do care, and we do need kind of. You know, this Bill of Rights, this agreement that there should be zero tolerance of this.
Right.
A decency pledge.
Right. And I think that's really, people really need to take that to heart. And I think that's where this needs to go. Because again, you know, you can do, HR departments in big companies are really helpful as well because people know they'll be accountable and they'll lose their job.
Yeah, but you look at, for instance, Uber and Susan Fowler, there was no help for her in the HR department at Uber. Right.
Well, a friend of mine was actually pitched by Uber about 3 weeks after the Fowler article came out. And this is a woman who co-wrote a book called Women in Technology. She was pitched by the HR person and responded, look, based on Uber at the moment, this is not a company I really would want to work for. And the female HR person came back to her and said, look, you and I both know sexism is a problem in the industry. We're working to work this out, but you really need to stop being so prissy about it. And it was,
I think,
just
that
like,
is the attitude of many men and even some women is, oh, come on, just buck it up.
Yeah.
Put up with it, slap the guy and move on.
Exactly. Just, you've got to change these things, either personally or as a corporate culture, but it just...
It's challenging.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to move on. We have many other things to talk about, and I know sometimes this is it's an uncomfortable subject and not really strictly about tech, except that it is, and I think it's important to talk about. So I'm glad we could get Katie Benner on. Thank Katie for joining us during her vacation. Denise is, of course, going to stick around. And by the way, I should point out, Denise is now on an iPhone. I don't know why it is, but for some reason her computer just can't do Skype. So it's perfect because we're going to celebrate the 10th anniversary of this technology in just a second. Thank you so much for being here, Denise Howell. Scott Bourne is also here, still not dead. And that's not my line, that's his, from photopodcasts.com. And we'll have a lot more. And Ian Thompson, too, from theregister.co.uk. Our show, a lot more coming up in just a second. Our show today brought to you by Carbonite Online Backup. I talk about Carbonite every weekend. Well, because they're a sponsor of the radio show, but also because I feel like the weekends are when people think about backing up, right? During their business day, the work day, you're busy, you got stuff to do, you're making, creating stuff, you're doing the spreadsheets, you're doing the balance sheets, you're doing the accounts receivable. You're probably not thinking, what would happen if all this stuff disappeared? Would we even have a business? So now, during the weekend, it's a little slower, you get a little time to think about it. I want you to think about Carbonite. Carbonite Online Backup. Here's what every backup solution should have. And you should ask your IT person, or if you're the IT person, ask yourself, do we fit this? First of all, I'm a big fan of Peter Krog. He's the photographer. His 3-2-1 backup. Three copies of everything, right? An original and two backups. On two different media. Don't put everything on a CD or a DVD or a hard drive. But one of those should be off-site. That is the most important part. It should be somewhere away from your premises. So if there's a fire or a flood, some big act of God, your data doesn't go along with everything else. You can survive a business burning down. You got insurance. You got fire insurance. You can survive that. But could you survive losing your customer list, your supplier list, your accounts receivable, all your books, all your data? Maybe not. You got to get Carbonite. Go to Carbonite.com. They've got plans for home and office. And by the way, the biggest threat to business these days, ransomware. And Carbonite can help you there, too. Take a look on the business side. It's Carbonite for Office at the resources page. There's a great bunch of white papers, including ransomware mitigation and how you can use Carbonite to protect you when the worst happens with ransomware. They're sponsors of OpenRansomware.org, and it really is an important subject. Business has to look straight in the eye. I know businesses that are literally stockpiling Bitcoin so that when they get ransomware, they can pay the bad guy. That is not the right plan. Carbonite.com. Go there. Take a look at the plan. Sign up for the one that's right for you. You can try it free with no credit card. Free. But do use TWIT as the offer code because you'll get 2 months free with purchase. It's not too late yet. Carbonite.com. Offer code TWIT. 10 years after the iPhone. Oh. Could somebody get me my iPhone 1? It's on the green stand in my office. Thank you, Burke. I remember very well Scott Bourne. I vividly remember this. We were doing Mac Break Weekly, and you knew there was going to be an iPhone. You were the iPhone fanatic on the show, right?
I did a podcast called The Apple Phone Show.
That's right. It was the number one podcast on iTunes for some time.
Yeah, we were like higher than Oprah for a while. I mean,
that was after the iPhone came out, right?
No, actually, we started the Apple Phone Show 90 days before the official launch, which led to that fateful day when you and John C. Dvorak, there in the theater in the round by the carousel
was
over there.
Was he sitting next to me? Because I blocked that part out. I remember you.
He was sitting next to you, and he did his famous thing that's made him very successful. That'll never work. He said that about 100 times, and I said, no, it's going to be kind of big.
Oh, you've been so excited. We said you made a vest out of iPhone. We had all sorts of jokes about you. Merlin Mann and I and Alex Lindsay.
They were telling the Chuck Norris jokes about me.
Yeah. Scott Bourne has so many iPhones. So, in fact, where is that picture? Because there's a great picture of you coming out of, I think, where was it? The San Francisco Apple Store? The Apple Store.
Yeah, 10 years ago when the Apple Store was where it's supposed to be, when Virgin Records was across the street,
right.
And when there was some pepper in my salt and pepper hair. Yes, 10
years
ago. I
got to find that picture. Is it on your
site?
There
was a picture.
Something?
Actually, it was a me being stuck in the iPhone in the front window of the San Francisco.
But there's also one of you holding up your bag in triumph coming out of the store.
That was in the San Francisco Chronicle.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, yeah.
That is a happy man.
That was like I was like the first guy.
Really? Were you first in line?
I was first or second. Well, I got to be honest here. I did not stand in line. One of my staff did. But then I went in and paid.
So you swooped in.
Then Greg, who was the guy who stood in line for me, we had this idea. You know, probably ought to take the phones and put them in your pocket in case during your celebratory hoist, someone grabs the box out of your hand.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
That was an empty box I was hoisting. And yes, I was happy because... You know, I just sort of had a feeling this was going to change everything, and I think I was kind of right that time.
That is the picture of a happy man, the Apple employee standing there smiling, everybody's smiling, cameras in your face, down there on Market Street at the old Apple store.
Remember that time you picked me up when I picked up a new Mac, and we were like...
We're standing on the corner, and it's not the best neighborhood in the world. We're standing in the corner.
$10,000 Mac into your car.
We had boxes on boxes. I'm standing on the corner. I'll never forget that, Scott. So here it is. This is it. This is the iPhone that changed. This changed more than just how we think of phones. This changed a lot.
You see, this is kind of embarrassing because I was a skeptic about the iPhone when it first came out.
No, that's
out.
Nothing to be embarrassed
about. Because I was using a Nokia N95, and in comparison
I
to
loved
that,
the N95.
The specs on that were terrible.
Yeah. I had a BlackBerry Pearl, which also was probably a more capable phone.
Mm.
But what happened with this is because of its success, this launched a manufacturing industry in China where accelerometers, GPSs, mm-hmm. radios, screens, all of the technologies that went in the iPhone suddenly became cheap, widely available. We wouldn't have drones if it weren't for the iPhone. There's a lot of technology we wouldn't have had the giant manufacturing capabilities of the iPhone not been created just to support this device. And I don't know. I think even you, Scott, probably didn't anticipate what a life-changing event that was.
No, because I wouldn't have bailed out of my Apple stock at $200 a share.
Oh, that's going to hurt. Yeah.
Well, $200 a share before the split.
Yeah, let me make something clear, Leo.
Yes.
The most expensive decision I have ever made in my life, times a billion, was to be a host on Mac Break Weekly.
Why is? Oh, because
we
sold,
agreed it would.
You sold your
we
shares.
We agreed
to be
it
on
would probably
show.
Be best if I sold my Apple shares.
Oh God! No wonder you hate me.
No, I love you. I would do it all again, even though it cost me $7.9 trillion. No,
it didn't. Have you done the math though? Had you ever figured out what those shares would be worth?
I figure it out every day. You need. I was dollar cost averaging at $49.9. I got out at $200 and thought I did good. But anyway.
Well, you did do good. That's a 500% growth.
Yeah, I'll take that. If I could do that again every day, I'd be happy. Anyway, I did not know financially what would be happening. I had no clue that it was going to be Apple's core business. But what I kind of did think, I remember everyone arguing with me all the time about all the stuff it didn't have. And I said, y'all are missing one real crucial point. People don't buy anything because of what it doesn't do. They buy it because of what it does do. Mm. And the notion that you have this thing without a keyboard that had a screen that when I first saw it, I was actually more impressed than I thought I would be. And, you know, obviously that first phone didn't, you know, a 2-megapixel camera.
It didn't have cut and paste.
And
we should remember there was no App Store at the time, so you couldn't.
It was a 2.5G phone in a 3G world.
That didn't even have 3G.
Yeah. And it was just like, we were like, are you kidding me? And then I saw somebody with one of them in public and the amount of buzz it got. And when you actually try the UI for the first time, and you're like, it's kind of like the first time as a Brit when I first tasted New York pizza, and it's just like, that's what it's supposed to taste like.
Oh,
And it's the same with the mobile phone. It was just like, that's what the UI is supposed to be like, and that's what's going to be the game changer. And the second big warning was when AT&T power networks started falling over.
That's right. It was terrible. You couldn't use it.
Thousandfold increase in data use.
They had no idea. In fact, whoever it was the chairman, was it Ralph?
Yeah.
He was the chairman of AT&T, said the biggest mistake I ever made was offering unlimited free data when the iPhone came out. Denise, when did you get your first iPhone?
That first year.
You
not,
did.
Not came out, but, I let Robert Scoble buy his, and then a couple of weeks later when died down, I had mine.
Yeah, I was chatting with Scoble on Friday. He said that he was down at the Palo Alto store and he was first in line for it. Is that correct?
He was. I remember there's a very similar picture to Scott Bourne's picture of Scoble coming out of
the
Palo Alto store.
Okay, right.
No, he was fully dressed. I remember waiting in line. I waited in line 6 hours here at the AT&T store in Petaluma. The fun thing about in those days, Apple lines kind of went downhill, and now they don't even do them because Angela Arendt, the head of retail at Apple, doesn't want lines. Mm-hmm. And I think she's right. It's not nice to consumers. It's great for marketing, but it's terrible for consumers. But the people you would meet in those early days, and certainly that first time in line, were really interesting, cool people. The people in front of me, the two guys in front of me, had been up all night. They worked at Google. They were rewriting Google Reader to work in the iPhone interface, and they'd stayed up all night, and then they had driven because they thought, well, we won't be able to get it in San Francisco. The line's way too long, but let's go up to the farm capital up in Petaluma. We probably can get an iPhone there. And they did. It was really cool and fun, and as with much Apple stuff, it was a cult in the early days.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, I stood in line for the iPad 2 because we wanted to get one for review. And the first 30 people in the
line sitters
who basically went in, bought their hardware, handed over to the bloke with the big bag outside, took their cash and walked off.
Yeah, the same thing happened with the iPhone. There was a big until they started selling the iPhone in China, there were a lot of Chinese sellers who would occupy places in line so that they could get their phones to sell in China.
I remember they had to limit it to – they started sort of ad hoc limiting the sales to 6 phones per person within a few minutes of opening at the main Apple store on Market Street because that was what was happening. People were buying a bunch of them. I actually legitimately wanted 6 for my staff, but that was all I could buy. And it was absolute mayhem. But, Leo, we walked around the corner – all 4 corners and found the line, and we were doing interviews with people, and that was for us for the Apple phone show. That was great. And Alex was with me. Alex from MacBreak Weekly for those of you.
Alex Lindsay.
And we were walking around and we shot video and we got so much material out of that deal. We could have done 10 shows, but I mean, think about how much it's changed beyond all the stuff we talked about. I mean, when you put a little kid in front of an iPhone, they immediately start trying to, pinch and zoom and they walk up to my big screen. My next door neighbor's granddaughter was over, walked up to my big screen, was trying to pinch and zoom on my 70-inch TV.
And I see it all the time with laptops. Sadly, with Mac laptops, people trying to touch the laptop. Even people who know better.
But, that's Apple just being stupid about their laptops. But I mean, in terms of it is that instinctive thing.
It's very natural.
And it's one of the things that scares me because a lot of my friends have got kids now. They pick it up really quickly, but they're just hooked on these things. If you would if they want to punish the kid, you don't. Give it a smack around the side of the head like it was growing up. You take away their iPad or take away their power cord, so they've got very limited
but Denise,
time on it.
I'm sure Denise will back me up when I say it punishes the parent when you do that as well.
It does, but you've got to get them off those things.
What do you do with how old is your son?
He's 13.
Yeah, we have a 14-year-old. If we don't intervene, screen time easily 14 hours a day. Easily.
Wow.
Easily.
Yeah. I haven't wanted to count.
Now, and I'm of mixed feelings because on the one hand, obviously, that can't be good for them. But on the other hand, that's the world they're growing up in. Who knows? They may be getting the best skill, the best training for their future right then playing those games. Let me show the video. Now, remember, the iPhone was announced at Macworld Expo in January. And those of us, remember this, Scott? We're at Macworld Expo. We're covering it for MacBreak Weekly.
I do.
And they had one iPhone in a case with guards on either side. You couldn't touch it. You could barely look at it.
And there was a reason for that.
Let me show you this. This is, so Scott, you're sitting next to me. I feel like Merlin and Alex are also with me, and you say John C. Dvorak's also in there.
Well, no, he was with us when we went to the theater in the round and did the Twitch show.
Oh, the Twitch show. I remember that. Yeah, this is us sitting in Moscone Center
during the keynote.
During the keynote, Steve Jobs is on stage. Let's watch a little bit because this is. We watched it in January, but I don't mind watching it again.
This is the master of presentation.
There will never be anybody, never was and never anybody better at a tech keynote than this guy.
The first one.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm going to back up just a little more because he said something.
Today, we're introducing three revolutionary products.
Now, Scott, you're the one who said there's going to be an iPhone. We didn't even know the name. You said there's going to be an iPhone.
I did.
And when he said three products, what did you think?
I wasn't worried.
Well, let's see.
I had insider info.
You knew. Oh, you did. Did you really? Oh, you didn't tell us.
I kept saying that. Merlin didn't think I was telling the truth, but I did.
Oh, I didn't know this. All right, listen.
I had a bowl.
Three new products.
Class.
Yeah.
The first one is a widescreen iPod with touch controls.
Now, the crowd is not in on this yet.
No.
They think, and the iPod, let's not forget, is the most successful Apple product ever.
Mm-hmm.
It is huge. So a widescreen iPod with touch controls, that would be a big deal.
The second is a revolutionary mobile phone.
Oh, there's the phone. We didn't. No one knew for sure except Scott Bourne that there was going to be a phone. All right, so we got an iPod, a phone,
mm-hmm.
And the third is a breakthrough internet communications device.
Now, come on, Scott. At this point, you got to say, what are they talking about?
Yeah. I knew they were talking about Safari.
See, I didn't. I thought I was at this point. I confess, a little puzzled, and you can hear the crowd getting a little more tentative.
Hang on a second. It's like you've done a phone, you've done the iPod. What can this be that's so good?
Yeah.
As it turns out, they should have led with the iPhone. But yeah.
Well, watch.
So, three things: a widescreen iPod with touch controls, a revolutionary mobile phone, and a breakthrough internet communications device. An iPod. A phone and an internet communicator.
Now they're twigging.
An iPod. A phone. Are you getting it? These are not three separate devices. This is one device.
Now, normally journalists are cool. We sit on our hands at events like this. We don't
less
applaud.
So in the U.S., but certainly in the U.K., it is absolutely forbidden to.
Apple
to
for years brought in Apple employees to sit in the front rows to cheer, and the rest of us are sitting here quietly. I have a feeling, Scott.
I was applauding.
I think I might. I think I might have been on my feet at this point.
We all break the rule for a really good product. I've done it myself.
This was a rule break,
and we are calling it iPhone. Today,
I'm patting Scott on the back because he named it.
Apple is going to reinvent the phone. And here it is.
And then the joke, of course, because it's an iPod with a dial.
Yeah.
And you got to love Steve. I mean, here he is at probably the peak moment of his life.
Actually,
and he does
here
this
it is,
joke.
But we're going to leave it there for now.
Wait, hey!
So...
What a tease.
Before we get into it.
Yeah.
Anyway, this really, the master. And and a moment I will never, ever forget. I mean, just incredible.
I think it was absolutely short of maybe just the original Mac announcement, his best keynote ever.
Yeah.
Mm. And the tease was brilliant. And by the way, I wasn't the only person that knew. I'm sure several hundred marketing people at Apple knew. But, you know, we had enough information to be pretty successful at gleaning what was going to come. I think none of us, even I as probably the largest proponent, and that's, by the way, measured by all metrics available, size, weight, and enthusiasm, I wasn't sure that it was going to take off the way it did. But I was sure one thing, that I was going to buy it, even though it was on AT&T, whose motto at the time was, and maybe still is, we're not happy until you're not happy.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're right, because you remember the AT&T network failed almost instantly as people started using their iPhones.
Well, data usage went up 8,000% in the space of 3 months.
Wow.
You know, the guy that said we're going to do the all-you-can-eat data plan, you know what happened to him about 3 days later? He was working at the place where he says, would you like fries with that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I know, it's. I mean, it was a good, but also in the way that they set out, you know, they got an exclusive deal with AT&T. They got, you know, it was Apple all the way. It was a very closed system. You couldn't write apps for it. You had to hand over control completely to Cupertino, which is very much the way they do things now.
It hasn't changed. Yeah.
At least they did open it up to third-party apps, because once they realized that battle was lost, then it was like, right, we've got to open this up, but we're going to keep very tight control in the closed walled garden that Apple has.
We're learning so much more now here on this 10th anniversary. Of course, we talked last week about the Computer History Museum interview with the iPhone creators. We're going to have a triangulation with one of the iPhone creators who has written a book. What's it called? The One Perfect Thing? I can't remember, but it's that'll be coming up Monday or a week from Monday. Here, by the way, if you didn't believe me, here's video of the iPhone in its
whoever first
this is, all the time. This is David Pogue's video. Oh, I want to find that bit where he shows at Macworld Expo the iPhone. I can't find it, but he shows the iPhone in its cylinder, its plexiglass cylinder. And what we learned is there were only three or four iPhones at the time of Steve's keynote,
and none of them worked very well.
None of them worked 100%. He had a very, very specific roadmap of what he could do, and if he deviated, it was very likely it would crash. They had a second one ready in case the first one crashed. But Steve, again, the master, he rehearsed, and he got it exactly right. The iPhone engineers who were responsible for different parts of the iPhone were sitting in the audience, and we now know, drinking heavily, and each time one of the engineers' particular invention, the radio or the screen, got shown and the demo worked, he would drink. And they said by the end of it, we were all blotto.
Yeah.
But they deserved it, because they had worked their butts off for a couple of years nonstop to create this thing. And still, there was a lot of work to do. It was not a finished product
January. This is something Apple has form for. They do show stuff off early before it's actually ready for it. But then they come through true. I mean, Apple didn't invent the smartphone, and BlackBerry made the smartphone necessary. Apple invented the touchscreen smartphone and made it desirable. I mean, we all loved our BlackBerries up to a point, but they weren't something that you actually desired. It was the functionality you desired. With the iPhone, I mean, I was in the UK, and I saw somebody using one of these very ostentatiously in a pub, and women were swarming around him, men were swarming around him.
It was a good way to get to know people.
Oh, my God, can I touch it? It
was just, for a long time, having the brand-new Apple thing guaranteed that you would get attention in an airplane.
Yeah.
Like if you had the iPad when it just came out of the iPhone, there you would get a crowd. That doesn't happen anymore, unfortunately.
And it was a little bit like with the original Macs, right? Because people brought the iPhone into work when their work was issuing them BlackBerries.
Right.
And they found that they could get much more done with their iPhone than with their BlackBerry, and they pushed that. And I think that there was this response from the enterprise that sort of lagged the consumer group of people running out and waiting in line, and oh, it's so fun, it's so beautiful, but the functionality is really what got it. Soon companies had bring your own device programs.
That's
and
right.
Yeah,
changed that. It actually really changed enterprise IT dramatically, because the iPhone was a wedge into the business. You're exactly right.
Oh, but I mean, it was a wedge at the top as well, because I spoke to we got an email through in my former employer saying, if you want to use an iPhone in the office, we now support that. And I was friends with the IT guys, as you'd expect. I was just like, I thought last time we were in the pub, you said that over your dead body, because it was such a pain to implement. And he said, it is such a pain to implement. I loathe it with a passion, but every board director has got one.
That's why
we're supporting it now.
We have to support it.
Yeah. I mean,
some people got it.
I just want to quickly point out along those lines, I happen to have a good memory, and I remember Palm and the CEO talking about how the iPhone wouldn't last very long.
Absolutely.
Does anybody remember what happened to Palm? Because
yeah,
I don't.
Yeah.
You know, RIM, which is BlackBerry, same thing. Microsoft saying, come on.
Steve Ballmer said nobody will buy it. It's too expensive. It was, by the way, $499. It wasn't relative to current iPhones. Yeah. It was actually not that expensive, nobody'd seen a phone at that price.
Yeah, I mean, that Ballmer cut of him saying, laughing himself sick over the iPhone, well worth watching every time there's an iPhone anniversary, because it's just like, that's why Microsoft nearly died on its backside.
Yeah. Well, let's show it. Here we go. Here's Steve Ballmer, and then go ahead. I'll let you talk again.
Steve, let me ask you about the iPhone and the Zoom, if I may. Zoom was getting some traction, then Steve Jobs goes to Macworld, and he pulls out this iPhone. What was your first reaction when you saw that?
$500, fully subsidized with a plan? I said, that is the most expensive phone in the world, and it doesn't appeal to business customers because it doesn't have a keyboard, which makes it not a very good email machine. Now, it may sell very well or not. We have our strategy. We've got great Windows Mobile devices in the market today.
A
Motorola Q phone now for $99. It's a very capable machine. It'll do music. It'll do internet. It'll do email. It'll do instant messaging. So I kind of look at that and I say, well, I like our strategy. I like it a lot.
I can't blame him, though. I'll be honest with you. Go ahead.
He wasn't getting work-life balance. He wasn't getting that people who were working wanted all those.
Right.
They wanted their music. They wanted all the other things the iPhone could do in order to be productive while they were working.
There's also, I mean, let's face it. If you just are looking at, specs alone, it is not an unreasonable thing to say, no one's going to pay $500 for this. What Ballmer underestimated, many people underestimated, is the magic that was Apple and their ability to market, their ability to excite people to, and most importantly, I think, to get people to buy into their vision. And it really, this isn't really anywhere near the end game. This is, and I remember the first Mac wasn't either, right? No. But Apple
had. And that's the crucial point.
Go ahead.
That's the crucial point, Leo. I was seeing, as a photographer, I was seeing the impact that this could have in version 3, 4, and 5. And I was meeting with people from the big camera companies, and they were having the same reaction as Ballmer. They were scoffing. This will never impact us. Well, if you look at the SIPA data, which is the camera association out of Japan that shows sales up to about 2007, 8, 9, 10, they absolutely started to just dive. Yeah. And they've been diving and diving and diving every year until last year. They finally, the growth curve started to flatten out a little bit, but it decimated the point and shoot camera market. It does not exist anymore. And when I was talking to people, I said, you might want to factor this in and try to make your cameras work with these things. And they poo-pooed it and they passed and they're just out of business. So I think that there's a lesson for all of us to be learned here is to look at the first version of something and try to have a little bit bigger vision than you do for what's right in front of you and look at the possibilities, because we all know that's what made Steve Jobs really special. And I think those days at Apple died with him, unfortunately.
I agree with you 100%, but the people who were not in the reality distortion field maybe didn't get it. But in fact, there was something there. Look at this. Ricoh did a whole bunch of graphs about how the iPhone changed the world. This is, to your point, digital photos taken worldwide by device. This is only in the last 6 years. In 2011, 50% by phone. In 2017, 87% of the world's pictures, more than a trillion pictures, taken on a camera phone.
Yeah.
Look at this. The black slices cameras and the gray slices tablets. I mean, this is the camera most people use now.
And right now, ever in the last year, more photos have been taken than have been taken in the rest of human history combined. We're entering a really weird time when it comes to humans putting their mark on sort of literature and pictures and the rest of
Here's another one. Voice versus data traffic in monthly bytes. going back to 2007, voice is that little red box at the bottom, which didn't change at all. The big curve there, of course, is data.
But it's weird. I mean, we've got younger people in the office now, and they hate talking to people on the phone.
I don't talk to anybody on the phone. Mike Elgin wrote a great piece in the Computer World this week about this is no longer a phone. It's a pocket computer.
Yeah.
And what really is going to happen is that voice service companies, like the cellular companies, are selling a product that is becoming rapidly obsolete because of voice over LTE, voice over Wi-Fi. Rapidly, we're seeing a situation where the data is all that really matters. You've got, look at you don't buy WhatsApp for $24 billion if you think SMS is the next big thing, right? There is a big change. I think we're working to get Denise Howell back. Let me take a break while we do that, and we will have more in just a bit. Denise Howell is here from Twill This Week in Law. From the photo podcasts at photopodcast.com. How many do you have, Scott Bourne?
We have 4 shows monthly now, and we're growing. We just started this enterprise a couple of months ago. My friend Marco LaRouse from Hamburg, Germany, a tremendous street photographer, and I. And we're doing a Q&A show, a mirrorless show, a gear show, and an inspiration show.
Oh,
so
fun.
Everybody's welcome. Come by and check us out at photopodcast.com.
Well, I told you before the show, while I brought my big heavy DSLR, my Canon 5D Mark IV, on our last vacation to the Galapagos and Machu Picchu, Lisa, my wife, said, that's too heavy. She thought about the Sony. She has an A7R II, a very nice full-frame Sony. Still too heavy. She went with her favorite camera of all time, the Olympus OMD. She has an EM1. I got her the Mark II just before the trip, so she'd have the latest, greatest. And she took great images. She loved it. She never complained about the weight while I'm lugging around 20 pounds and 3 lenses. And I know you're an Olympus shooter now, Scott. So I showed her all your pictures, and I said, you're right. You get amazing wildlife photos.
Well, thank you. It's changed my life. I had a conversation with my doctor in November, and he said, look, you have to put down these big, heavy lenses, and you got to do it today. If you don't, you're going to be in a wheelchair any day.
Yikes. Were you shooting? You were a Nikon shooter, right?
Canon. I shot Nikon and Canon, but mostly Canon because I needed their 800-millimeter lens for bird photography. Yeah. But, you know, I carried 40, 50 pounds of gear around on my shoulder for decades, and I had 11 shoulder surgeries. And my doctor said, look, I'm the best orthopedic surgeon in the Northwest. I can't help you. There's nothing left to work with. You got to stop. And about that time, Olympus announced the OMD EM1 Mark II. I bought them. I bought them with my own money, by the way. And then they called me and said, would you like to be on our visionary team? It's the highest honor I've ever received in my career. I'm grateful to them.
You deserve it. Look at this. This is that you just came back from the Pacific Northwest.
Wow.
This is with an OMD. This is with a Micro Four Thirds.
By the way, that's handheld on a moving boat in 30 knot winds.
Holy cow. Look at that. That is a bald eagle, right?
That's a bald eagle with a fish in his talon.
That's a shot that any photographer. That's a shot of a lifetime. Any photographer.
By the way, that's to test the new autofocus with tracking. That bird is flying straight at me. That's the hardest test, if you want to know, for an autofocus is to get a bird tracking straight at you, or anything moving straight at you for that matter. That's when I knew that I was going to be able to make the switch.
Which lenses are you using for the OMD?
I primarily use the 300 f/4, which has got a field of view of 600, and the 40-150, which has a field of view of 80-300. Those are probably 90% of my shots.
I know how hard these shots are because I'm trying in the Galapagos in a moving Zodiac, a rubber boat, to shoot the frigate birds who fight for the fish because they can't fish for themselves. And they're moving and they're swooping, and I got nothing in focus. So I really I really appreciate how hard this is.
That's a lovely shot.
But here's an important thing. This is a Micro Four Thirds sensor, but the clarity and the detail is stunning.
Yeah, they've come a long, long ways with that, and it's amazing. The folks at Olympus are dedicated to this, and you know, obviously it saved my career, so I'm grateful to them. And if any of you out there are worried that you can't make the switch and be successful, I'm here to tell you you can.
Nice. Scott Bourne. .com, B-O-U-R-N-E, and a lot of his pictures are up there, including those new eagle shots.
Thank you for showing that. That was very generous of you, Leo.
Oh, they're gorgeous. Scott, I've been following you avidly as you post those on Facebook, and each time I go, damn it.
Well, hey, you know what? You have an invitation for me live on Twit. to come with me next March to Alaska, and I'll show you how to do that.
I tell you what, I now I'm thinking maybe I should have just kept the OMD and oh well, live and learn. I've spent so much money on cameras, and
you do love your cameras.
I love them, but I look at what Lisa got and what you're getting with this great camera, and I'm very impressed. You know who else loves it is Andy Anatko, is a big OMD guy.
Well, I gave Andy his first Olympus camera.
Oh, did you? Oh, I didn't know that. Oh.
Yeah. I've actually been using their gear on and off for other stuff ever since the EM5 days.
I bought an EM5. I liked the pen. I remember the pen because it was like an old-fashioned camera. I thought, this is the greatest thing ever.
I also have one of the new Pen Fs, which is a beautiful camera as well. Nice. But the time when you have to worry about there being enough resolution, you can't print big, it's going to be too noisy, all that stuff's fixed. The autofocus is right up there with most of the DSLRs if you know what you're doing. So it ended up, I sold two big lenses, a 600 and an 800, and I bought every single thing Olympus makes.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's cheaper.
Tells you something, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Our show today brought to you by my doorbell. Oh, I wish I had my Amazon Echo Show.
That's the new one.
We got one. I ended up buying three. I love them, but that's the new Echo with the screen. And now I can say, Echo, show my front door. It's hooked up to the Ring Video doorbell. I can see what's going on in my front door. And if somebody's at the door, I could talk to them. The Ring Video doorbell and the Amazon Echo. It's a match made in heaven. I love the Ring. We've been talking about the Ring a lot. This is something that I think Jamie created it. Maybe he was on Shark Tank, and he had something a door bot, it didn't get the money on Shark Tank, so he went back to the drawing board, and he created the Ring doorbell, and everything changed. Now Richard Branson's a big investor. They are coming out with new products all the time. In fact, they have a brand new Ring Pro.
We're reviewing it at the moment. Yes,
it's awesome. So this is a doorbell with an HD camera, a speaker, a microphone, and a motion sensor. It replaces your existing wired doorbell. You can also use the original Ring as a battery, so you can use it without wired doorbell. It was easy for me. I just unscrewed that old crappy. Everybody seems to, like, I don't know, is this the case? We buy a new house, beautiful house. There's always a crappy, like, 50-cent doorbell, and it's kind of not working, and the donger, the chime in the house goes, dun, and it's just, I don't know what it is. It's like the last thing. So I just unscrewed it. Two wires are coming out of the door jam. Ring gives you in the kit. I have it right over here. I'll show you. The Ring gives you everything you need. I'm no handyman, but about an hour later, I've got the whole thing. And by the way, I'm slow. You could do it in less time, but I watched all the YouTube videos and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got a level, and they've got a mount and a mounting plate. And you just, and then.
They include a spirit level in the box.
That's they cute. Do. Isn't that nice? And the mounting plate, it's actually much nicer installed than the original doorbell I replaced it with. And now when somebody comes to the door, even if they don't ring the doorbell, I get a notification on my smartphone because you pair it to your smartphone. When they ring the doorbell, I get a notification, and I could say accept and say, yeah, what do you want? And if it's a UPS guy, don't tell him this, but I just say, yeah, I'm in the shower right now. Leave it. I'll sign for it tomorrow. And it works. And I don't have to worry about the packages on the porch because I can see them. This is where you want a security camera.
But you need a function in there so that if the Jehovah's Witnesses come round, you can have release the hounds.
I just tell them I'm a Satanist, and they go right away. I don't know. It's great. The Ring. No, I don't. The Ring Video Doorbell. They have a new variety of them. There's, of course, the Ring stick-on cam, which is a doorbell minus the doorbell. So it has the camera, speaker, microphone, and then it has solar panels, so you don't have to plug it in, and it sends pictures of any other part of your house. They have the new floodlight cam, which is this plus a floodlight. So there's the stick-up cam, then there's the floodlight cam, which is, you've seen the floodlight, somebody goes behind your house, they turn on. This does that, but also has a camera, so you can see what's going on, and you can talk to them. So it's got two-way audio, so you can say, hey, get out of there, which scares the heck out of the garbage man every week. I love it. It's Wall Street Journal's Best of CES for 2017.
Service stuff, we're going to love your ass.
He's talking to us again. We're going to give you up to $150 right now off a Ring of Security kit. All the kits have a Ring Video doorbell and your choice of one, two, or three floodlight cams so you can light up the whole home. It works with your favorite smart locks, works with your favorite hubs, works with your Amazon Echo. Ring.com/twit. And there's the kits, and you can save up to $150. I got to tell you, this not only for yourself, for like my elderly mom who can't really get to the door very easily. It's a really great solution for her because she can say, "Oh, you know, I'll be with you in about a minute," and she, you know, she can get to the door and stuff, or not answer. You know, it's really nice. Everybody, and I see more and more of these in neighborhoods. Ring even has a deal they do with neighborhoods and the local police. They did this in the Southern California. They put a Ring video doorbell on in a small town. 1 out of 10 houses, not all of them, just 1 out of 10. Crime went down more than 50% because the crooks go, "I'm not coming anywhere near that neighborhood. They've got cameras everywhere." Ring, you can read about it on the Ring website. Ring.com/twit. Love it. All right. I think I'm trying to figure out what's going on with poor Denise. This is she's
stuck
also
in the iPhone.
She's also on vacation, and I think we've lost her entirely now. It's like everything's not working. Well, let's keep working on getting her back, and we will if we can. We do, fortunately, have the great Ian Thompson from theregister.co.uk.
That's not a phrase I hear that often, the great Ian Thompson. I like the sound of that.
I like you it. Know? You are the great Ian Thompson. We love having you on. And somebody who's not been on in a coon's age, if that's okay to say these days, I don't know.
That's a raccoon.
In a raccoon's age.
Oh, trash pandas. Okay.
Trash pandas. It's a Scott Bourne. It's so great to see you, Scott.
Great to be seen.
In his studio, the photo podcast studio, where he's always
had. Have you seen my license plate up here, Leo?
I can only see photo. What does it say? Take it down. Is it a California plate?
Washington plate. I live in Washington.
You have your photo?
I'm photo.
Wow.
I'm photo in several states.
I thought they had to have a certain number of letters and numbers on them. I'm not.
They have to have at least 5, that's for sure.
Oh, I see. It's
if
at least
you're
five.
Scott Bourne, Scott's got ways. He's got friends everywhere.
I also have the plate bouquet, which some people call bouquet.
Now, how do you pronounce it? B-O-K-E-H.
Japanese, the word is properly pronounced bouquet.
Okay.
Okay.
The only reason I say bokeh.
In Japanese, it means sort of a fuzzy concept, sometimes used as a slang term for that guy's crazy. So it perfectly applies to me.
It's the blurry background on a picture that has shallow depth of field. And we always, it's like the bouquet in wine. It's the kind of thing camera aficionados go on and on about the bouquet in the picture. It's creamy or it's... You know,
there's a button for it in the iPhone 7.
I know. What do you think of portrait mode, by the way?
It's a poor man's bouquet.
It's fake bouquet.
I believe that this is great for everyone who wanted to up their game that was going to shoot with a point and shoot. I think everybody's pictures are better. I think everybody's taking more of them, which is important. I think that Instagram is a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in that more people get their work seen. It's a curse in that nobody prints anymore, but I still print. Things move on. You have to adapt, and I've tried to do that my whole career, and that's why I'm still here.
And as we've always said, it's the photographer, not the camera, and there are people getting amazing pictures with iPhones.
Well, you know, somebody said to me, "I saw your Eagle pictures you took. You must have a really good camera." I said, "Yeah, I bought it the same place Mozart bought the piano."
Or Hemingway got his typewriter, right?
Yeah.
Joanna Stern, we tried to get her on. Can I say what she is? Is that secret? She's a new mother, so we'll get her on. We'll get her on when she's not changing diapers. But she was brave. She took the original iPhone 10 and tried to use it. 10 years later,
yes.
So small, so slow.
Fun article.
Forget everything physicists have said. Traveling back in time is super simple. Get an original iPhone. Find a cellular carrier that still has a 2G network.
That's the rub.
Hello, T-Mobile. Pack a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, knitting supplies, fidget spinner, whatever you need to pass the time. There's a lot of waiting on technology back then. Power on the phone and welcome to 2007. She is a brave woman. She was hoping to get at least a day. She got 12 hours. It's not
easy. The battery life wasn't quite what it is now.
Well, especially a 10-year-old phone. She says she got it on Craigslist.
That is one of the weird things, though, because, I mean, growing up with Nokias, you got used to a week-long battery life.
Right.
And then the smartphones
came
out.
Even the BlackBerry.
Yeah. And you came out and it's like... hang on, I've got to carry a power cord around with me the whole time. Are you effing kidding me? And yeah, but no, we've all become accustomed to it now. And, you know,
we're now. Keep in mind that all of them are better because of the iPhone. That's my opinion.
Anyway. I agree.
I have a Windows phone, by the way, as well, Leo. I have an iPhone, but I also have the latest, greatest, top of the line. It cost me $800, and it's actually worth $25 on Gazelle Windows phone.
Which Windows phone do you have?
Is that the HP one?
It's the Microsoft. I bought it in a Microsoft store. It was like $600 or $800. It was crazy expensive. Now I went to Gazelle just to see what it's worth. It's worth $25. But anyway, I actually like Cortana way better than I like
Siri. Siri ain't great. And this is, you know, for so we were talking a little bit of and you were saying that Apple has lost some of its mojo.
A lot of mojo. I mean, it's a freaking watch company now. It's the Pro Apps division, Aperture is gone. I remember you and I also sitting in that keynote and you saying Steve's going to do away with Aperture. Nope, he didn't then, but he did. They did as soon as he died. Yeah. I think that for me, I'm using both Windows and Macs. The reason I still use Macs, frankly, is I love Mac Fun software, and it's not on Windows yet. It will be soon.
Kevin LaRue was in the studio.
He was just there. He showed me a picture because he was just in my studio yesterday.
2 days ago, and he's, of course, the CTO over at Mac Fun, PHUN. They make really nice. They do Aurora HDR with Trey Radcliffe, who's the HDR king, and this is his new choice, and I really like it. They have Luminar, which is kind of an all-in-one program, and I saw that you were using Luminar.
I love Luminar. I got Photoshop, but I still use Luminar all the time.
Yeah, but I'm using a Windows machine. So Kevin said that the beta's coming out soon.
Well, you've got something I covet in front of you. Ever since that thing was announced.
Wouldn't you love doing your photo editing on the Microsoft Studio?
If somebody at Microsoft is listening, I'm stealable.
I bought it. It cost me a pretty penny. Let me tell you, this thing is not cheap.
I do use the Surface Pro instead of an iPad. I use some Microsoft products. Windows has gotten way better. And when you're in the Photoshop Lightroom environment, it really doesn't matter.
I am very disappointed, though, and you don't have probably this problem, but with the large files that come off the Canon, Lightroom is very slow moving.
Oh, it's horrible. It's horrible.
So what I want to do, and I'm sorry, we turned into photo show, but we'll stop in a minute.
What did you think it was going to happen when you fall on a photographer?
What I did is I got Photo Mechanic. Are you familiar with Photo Mechanic?
Photo Mechanic from Breeze Browser. It's incredibly fast.
And so what I do is it's the front end to my selection process. It doesn't do the editing that Lightroom does. But you can go through all the pictures instantly in Photo Mechanic. And I use Chris Marquardt's 3-star method. And I triage all my pictures. I had 4,000 images, got them down to 30 images. And then it automatically, all of the, the stars are imported instantly into Lightroom. And then you do your editing instead of on 4,000 images, on 30 images. And it's much better. So that's what I ended up using. And that's one of the reasons I'm on Windows. But I do think that it's not a long time before the iPad Pro will be a viable choice for this.
Well, as long as if we don't have people saying, well, you don't need an SD card reader and you don't need a USB connection. And I mean, that kind of stuff.
You can buy a dongle. There's a USB 3 dongle.
You can buy a dongle for anything from Apple these days.
Guess what? There's a movie that I saw years ago with Clint Eastwood called The Fistful of Dollars. And if you buy a new Mac product, you have to change the name of that movie to A Fistful of Dongles.
It's true.
I'm not going there.
It's true.
Yeah.
Fistful of dongles.
I think
we have a show title, ladies and gentlemen.
I probably bought my last Mac laptop. Wow. If that's the way they're going.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you use some. Okay, one more. I'm so sorry. You use something on Windows that I like a lot. Topaz Studio came out. I learned about it because of you. I've used the Topaz plugins for years, but now they have, like Luminar, it's an all-in-one kind of interface to it, and I like that a lot.
I use Topaz Impression a lot, which is their painterly program.
Yeah.
And that's cross-platform.
I think that's what you did that eagle with it, the last eagle.
That's the last eagle you showed. That's correct.
Yeah.
And as soon as Mac Fun is translated over to Windows, I'm probably going to be a full-time Windows guy.
Wow, that is kind of a sad and bitter story.
Well, you know, it's all because Mr. Cook did not come from the same part of Apple that Steve Jobs did, and his vision for the company is simply to make money. And God bless him, for the stockholders, that's the way to go. But as a guy who got involved with Apple because I liked their solutions, they just work. They were.
And now you know why we made you sell that Apple stock, so you'd be honest.
Yeah, I understand.
Because if you still had all those Apple shares, you might be tempted to thank Tim Cook, because he made
a
lot
be
of
tempted.
Money.
I would be tempted, but I would still, if you remember, I was pretty hard on Apple when they screwed up. But I think that if you look at the innovation right now, it's coming out of the Microsoft people.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting?
That's not something you ever would have thought.
Never.
Microsoft's history. I can't believe I said that sentence.
Ian. I know. It's weird, isn't it? It's just like we're in the Twilight Zone.
But this is the Surface Studio is a great example. I mean, it's not
quit
perfect.
Showing off.
Well, no.
Quit,
I was at the studio launch in New York, and when
this
they unveiled
is a great
it,
example.
When they unveiled this, that studio in the New York press conference, it was just like, wow, Apple are going to be looking at that like they've just eaten our lunch.
And they didn't, though. They mock it, and they still say, "Oh, you don't need a touch. Why would you ever want?" I'll show you why you'd want touch, Apple. This is why you'd want touch. You'd want touch so you could do, like, you could draw a mustache on the eagle. That's why you and little horns. That's why you'd want touch, ladies and gentlemen.
I think this comes back to what we were saying.
By the way, Leo, that doesn't count as a derivative work. We get Denise involved in that.
But I just think there are some things. This is such a natural way to scroll. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to belabor it, but I
also,
do think.
I'm sorry. When a company is saying you don't need that, you know the company's in trouble. It's just like.
No, you don't want that. Well, Apple's always done that. Steve Jobs said, you don't need a stylus. You don't need a keyboard.
Yeah, and then the minute he was dead, it was, okay, right.
Yeah. I think we got Denise back. Are you there?
I am here.
Sweet.
Well, good, because we're ready for the legal portion of the show. Are you ready?
I am.
This is the numbers section. This week, the EU decided that Google was sending people to its shopping site instead of just giving them good search results, mm-hmm. and they fined them $2.7 billion, €2.42 billion, mm-hmm. for giving illegal advantage of their own comparison shopping service. Google says we are going to appeal. Jeff Jarvis on This Week in Google, and in an article that he wrote for Politico.eu, said this is really has nothing to do with shopping. That the big newspapers and magazines in Europe are highly threatened by Google's advertising business. Axel Springer and Rupert Murdoch's News Corp lobbied the EU very hard to come down on Google. And by the way, this is not the last thing they're investigating Google for. They're also very interested in how Google's using the Android operating system and its monopoly there, and how Google's reduced choice by preventing third-party websites from sourcing search ads from Google's competitors with their AdSense. And I think, I'm not sure Jeff's wrong on this one. I really do think that the big business lobby has influenced the EU somewhat in this.
Up to a point. It's harder to influence the EU, for business to influence the EU, than it is for business to influence politicians over here. Because there isn't the kind of legalized bribery campaign financing structure that we've got here.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at, I looked at the fine, I looked at the judgment, and it could have been a lot worse, because the EU had the ability to fine Google up to €9 billion.
Good Lord.
And they called it a day at 2.4. I'm curious to what you think about this, Denise, because it seemed like a very odd ruling.
I just have two observations. I haven't looked too closely, and of course I'm not practicing in the EU and not very conversant in all of the intricacies of their interpretations of antitrust and this particular ruling. But I will tell you this. I think the EU is being far more aggressive on coming after companies for antitrust kinds of things than the US is right now. Mm-hmm. And
FTC was investigating Google and dropped its case.
That's what the FTC does, drop cases. Right. You know.
They're very good at that.
Secondly, no government likes thinking that search results are being manipulated to deceive people. So if the contention is Google should have been more forthright about disclosing exactly what results people were getting, Google knows that well. They've been through that, and they will continue to go through that, and they're going through it in a financial way as a result of the EU right now. And yes, they may appeal, and Jeff has good points, but I think it's a good cautionary note for any search engine that you know, be forthcoming. Let people know what they're getting. If you have a partnership with results that you are supplying, let people know that.
Yep.
And let that in a big, obvious way. And if you're not doing that, look out for governments coming after you.
It's true. I mean, we have so many technology firms who are in, if not near monopolies, then oligopolies. And certainly the regulators don't seem to be doing anything about it. At this end, I think the EU feels that if you're going to operate within their borders, then you've got to be subject to a certain amount of antitrust legislation. They're gunning for Google on the Android platform as well. But I honestly think a lot of this was just about the inherent unfairness of Google promoting its own shopping results. And I know Murdoch hates them because Murdoch wants to rule the world, and anyone who gets in his way gets stomped on. But, you know, we shall see.
If you look at, so part of this is that the EU defines a monopoly differently than the United States and trust differently than the United States. The EU, I'm told, and you're the lawyer, Denise, so correct me, the United States laws are designed to protect consumers from predatory monopolies. The EU laws, I'm told, are more slanted towards protecting other companies from predatory monopolies. So that may be why they maybe listen to Axel Springer and News Corp. But it's also the case that I don't think Google really was pushing people to shopping. If you searched for a product, there was an advertising bar that showed ads. It said, you know, advertisement. And then there were legitimate search results underneath that. I think that was clearly an ad. I don't think Google was trying to fool anybody. That's their business, is advertising. I'm not sure I accept the premise that they were trying to trick somebody.
Yeah, I'm not sure I accept it either. But I do remember the days when Google didn't have those promoted results at the top, right? And it was a pure experience.
Well, I agree. But those days are gone. It is, Google is a business.
Yeah.
And they can... I mean, I complain because Google has YouTube. I mean, I'm in the business of video, right? And if you search for a tech review, you're much more likely to find a YouTube result than a Twit result. Now, Google probably says, well, that's because more people are interested in the YouTube result. But I feel like Google, if it's going to be a pure search engine, shouldn't be in the content business.
Yeah.
Because now they're competing with me, and I'm afraid, I can't prove, but I'm afraid their search results favor their own business over mine.
I've got to say, it's the only reason I now use Bing is for searching for Bing Video. Because
you'll never see Bing Video on Google.
No, but I mean, if you actually search on Bing for videos, then you get both YouTube and everyone else.
Right.
Whereas if you search on Google, then YouTube gets promoted all the way down the line.
Right.
So I'm
aware of the idea that Google could, and I agree with you, Denise, that I would love to go back to those days when Google was pure search results, but they're in a lot of other businesses now. And
right. And of course, you know, disclosing what you're doing varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Right.
You know, what are you sufficient to make it clear that this is an ad, you know, this is something that we see not just in search results, but with the Fyre Festival. Are people posting because they want to go to the Bahamas or because they're being paid? It's something that I think is a work in progress on a number of fronts.
I want to ask you, Denise, about this Canadian High Court decision that tells Google it needs to censor search results worldwide instead of just Canada, and what the impact of that is. But before we do, I want to cut quickly to SpaceX, because they're about a minute away from another launch. They did a launch earlier this week. This is a communications satellite that Elon Musk's company is about to launch into space. And the only reason I'm showing this is I know a lot of you will otherwise stop watching live because you want to go to the SpaceX launch, so I don't want to lose you. But it really is, as we watch this, amazing what not just SpaceX, but Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin,
as a journalist, I've got to say, when the first launch last week on the Friday, not the Sunday one, went up, I watched it just to make sure nothing went wrong. And then when it didn't, it was kind of like, people honestly can't really justify this as a pure news story because Elon Musk said, you know, we will succeed when space launches become boring. And he's getting to that point now where you just expect it to go up and work fine. It's not going to give us the best
fireworks. And those amazing three-point landings as the launch stage comes back to Earth. I don't think they're doing that with this
one. No, it's too high up and too heavy.
Yeah. So we'll just watch.
So, Leo, in 10 years, do you think we'll be launching these things with an iPhone app?
Yeah, sure. You could do a drone with an iPhone. Why not?
Believe some of Apple's PRs. The iPhone will take you there personally.
As somebody who grew up watching Walter Cronkite and the Gemini and then the Apollo launches, I kind of, there's a certain nostalgia. I know you guys are a lot younger than me. But.
No, I trust me. I when they did the first landing, it was just like, right, boys, we're going to the pub to celebrate this. This is pretty a piece
exciting.
Of history.
Pretty exciting. Now they're in a hold, it looks like, at 9 seconds. Walter was very good at filling
John
those holes.
Yeah. Webcast, yeah. Net it's, here in Hollywood, California.
This guy isn't, though. He's got the charisma of a road accident, but he is.
He's no Walter Cronkite. I can remember Uncle Walter right would have a model on the desk of the Apollo rocket. And he would sit there and he'd have experts there and say, well, let's take a look at what might be going wrong.
Yeah.
And he could talk for 5 hours straight while they were in a hole.
It's an essential skill if you're going to be doing that kind of a job. You know, it's just like, you know, you get the earpiece and just fill in. It's like, oh, we're seeing it. Okay, right, let's. You know.
They called him Old Iron Butt because he could sit there and talk and talk. So, Denise, am I right in saying that this is a bad precedent? The Canadian Supreme Court, so the case was that there were two companies. One was copying the product of the other. Actually, they were buying it and relabeling it and selling it, making a counterfeit product. The company sued Google saying, you should delist these counterfeit products. You're supporting counterfeiting. We want you to take that listing down. Google fought it. And in the end, it went to the Canadian High Court, which decided that not only does Google have to take those listings down, it has to do it not just in Canada, but all over the world. That seems like a dangerous precedent.
Again. We're still waiting for word on.
It also seems difficult to implement, and it seems fairly consistent with what might happen under U.S. law since the IP violations are exempted out.
The problem I have is, well, fine. I mean, Canada, I like Canada. Not a bad country. They've got pretty reasonable laws. But what happens
when a
Turkish high court says, oh, you can't have anything on Google that's critical of Erdogan, our president, and we want you to pull it down worldwide? Then what happens? And so that's the problem, is that the laws differ considerably from country to country, and I don't want the lowest common denominator to determine what's on Google. Eventually, you've got nothing.
Well, we've got this problem with encryption at the moment because the word is that the US government and the UK government and various other governments all want to be able to backdoor encryption and to have a key to read and encrypt communications, which I'm sure they think is fine for them. But then if China then turns around and says, actually, we'd like the same. We've got some dissidents we'd like to put away for
a while. Exactly.
And yeah. What you can't say, well, it's okay for us, but it's not okay for you guys. And China's not going to accept that. I mean, almost all Western companies produce their kit in China. And if they don't agree with what the Chinese government says, the government can just turn around and say, yeah, you remember those factories you used to have? Yes, let's talk about those, shall we? And, you know, this is the same thing with the Google ruling in Canada. I don't see how that can be enforced.
Yeah, there's technical issues. It's the right to be forgotten. Same problem, right? How do you enforce that outside of the EU?
Right, and it all becomes a question of international treaty and how you're going to respect the other country's ruling and or not, not will.
So, in other words, while it is the Supreme Court and there's nowhere Google can go in Canada to appeal it, that doesn't necessarily the final word.
That's right. It does come down to.
Denise, you've turned into a blue. Oh, there we go. Go ahead. We're going to work on this. And it's much like SpaceX. We're in a hold.
Yeah.
And we will stay in a 15-second hold with SpaceX. We'll keep you up to date on that as the launch continues. And we will get Denise Howell working. And we will talk more to Scott Bourne, photopodcast.com, scottbourne.com, wildlife photographer extraordinaire. Nice to see you again. And, of course, Ian Thompson. Big news. Register.co.uk.
Yep.
Do you do any other podcasts or anything like that?
I'll pop down and have a chat with Jason once every 3 months or so.
But on Twist, This Week in Startups, yeah.
But other than that, we do an occasional podcast ourselves, but...
You just stick with us. We like having you here.
Well...
You don't need any of those other shows.
Unfortunately, I used to do some stuff for the BBC, but then the time delays started getting so bad. Oh, yeah. I was due for an interview at midnight.
Yeah.
And I got a call from the World Service saying, yeah, we're just going to kick this back about 2.5 hours. You okay with that? And it was
a DJ in London used to call me all the time, and the time changes killed me because he was a late-night DJ. It was not going to work. Stop doing it. Our show today brought to you by, here's the big news, WordPress. Now 28% of all the websites in the world are web by WordPress. It was 27%. That number is mind-boggling. 28% of all the websites in the world run on WordPress. I might add, my website, leolaporte.com, also runs on WordPress. I used WordPress, self-hosted WordPress for years, and I always loved it. But it was kind of a pain because I had to keep it up to date, keep it secure, and I ended up, it felt like I was doing more work just to keep it up to date than I was posting. So when I got WordPress.com, it was a real revelation. All the benefits of running my own site, but they do the hosting, they keep it up to date. Plus, you're part of a massive community. If you go to the front page at WordPress.com, you'll see tons of websites that are there. Let me just show you LeoLaporte.com. Because I'm on WordPress.com, you can follow me on WordPress.com, and I get thousands of views from WordPress.com, which is fantastic. There's even a follow button on my site. Besides, WordPress has the best templates. It looks so good, so easy to include my Twitter feed, my Instagram feed, any RSS. All my photos, it was very easy to export. And when I left WordPress, my hosted WordPress, and import right back into WordPress, because WordPress is so widespread and so widely used, there are so many great tools out there to work with WordPress. And I've known these guys for years, Matt Mullenweg. And I mean, this is just a great company. And they got better and better. Great for SEO. They automatically, optimize for social sharing. They optimize for SEO. You get a sitemap, all the things Google wants to improve searchability. You get amazing stats, so you know exactly what your viewers and readers are doing, what they're looking at, what they're not looking at. You get, of course, a great community that you're part of and support 24/7. Go to WordPress.com. Whether you're looking to create a personal blog, a business site, or both, you're going to make a big impact, and it's easy and it's affordable when you build your website at WordPress.com. We're going to make it even more affordable to celebrate 1% more, 28% now of the web. We're going to give you 15% off any new plan purchase at WordPress.com/twit. Somebody asked me on the radio show, where should I create my website? And I did not hesitate. Obviously, WordPress.com/twit, 15% off your brand new website. And thank you, WordPress, for great support, a great community, and really great software. Makes it easy to blog. I blog a lot more now, thanks to WordPress. Let's see. The Echo Show. Am I nuts?
I won't have one in the house, but, that's
it's really
me,
interesting. The world is divided among those who wouldn't dream of putting an Amazon microphone and camera in their home.
Any kind, not just Amazon, any kind of Microsoft, any microphone and camera in my home. No, thank you.
And yet, I think, who was it that said, this is the best new gadget of the year? This is the most, I love the Echo Show. It is an Amazon Echo with a built, $230, so it's more expensive. Mm. Although the original Echo, when it first came out, was $200, so it's not much more. But it has a built-in 7-inch tablet. I think the Echo uses the tablet very well for additional stuff. When you do a flash briefing, for instance, you can have video in it in some cases. So part of my flash briefing is the Tonight Show monologue. You actually get the video on the screen, which is great. You also get song lyrics when you're listening to music, so you can sing along. You get a constantly updated feed of news and weather. Pictures, you can have your images on it. You can get a slideshow. And it's got better speakers than the old Echo. It actually sounds really good. I have it in my kitchen. I got one for my mom because the biggest feature is you can call each other.
Right.
video call. I could say, you know, Echo, call mom. And if mom's in my address book and her phone number is registered as an Echo, it will call her Echo, whether an audio or an Echo show. I sent her an Echo show because I want to see her and she could see me. The drop-in feature was a little controversial. I don't think we fully understood it when they first announced it. I thought you could drop in and just see what was going on without it being announced. But in fact, the camera isn't automatically turned on, just audio. And it's really an intercom feature. So, and you have to enable it. There's all sorts of privacy controls. But I put, what?
We have two.
So, yeah, there you go. There you go. See?
Seems like the panel's Luddite, but no.
Maybe I'm doing it wrong, but when I drop in on one of ours, the camera starts right away.
Not on ours. It's a blurry image. Your camera starts. She could see you as the drop-in-er.
No, I can see them when there's no one.
No, not on ours. I don't know what you... Maybe you've changed a setting.
God, you've got a teenage son as well.
So exactly. I don't want to drop in on my teenager. Yeah. But it's great because I put it in Michael's room. He has the old Echo, the tube. But even if he had a show, you put it in his room and you say, drop in on Michael. And in his room, it goes bloop. And I can say, Michael, dinner's ready. And by the way, it's really loud. It's nice. But I don't see him unless he taps his screen and enables video. So maybe that's a setting.
The difference is you're doing intercom and I'm not. And I maybe need to change ours because we've got drop-in.
That would be bad.
Yes. I could drop in on my teenager.
That's not good. Well, I sent one to my mom. I don't want her dropping in on me anyway. And I'm not a teenager, but you know. Okay.
Huh. Yeah.
The intercom is neat because I can have an intercom across the country with my mom. I could just say, hey, mom, are you there? That I would do that a lot. And then you can also make video calls. But you're saying the camera, when you say drop in.
I think that intercom and drop in are two different things.
Oh.
And intercom was not available on mine when I set it up, so I enabled drop-in. And drop-in drops you in.
No, I've been using drop-in.
That's...
Okay, well, maybe I'm doing it wrong.
No, I think maybe I'm doing it wrong.
It must be a setting. But we were playing with it yesterday on the new screensavers. We have a couple in here. And it turns on the audio instantly. But I didn't see a picture. It was a blur, very blurry, not enough that you could see anything at all. Just blurry.
Sorry, if somebody put one of those in my room, I would put a thing over the camera just for privacy's sake.
Well, yeah, and so that's an interesting question. I mean, Scott Bourne, what's your opinion on the privacy issues of Echo? Are you an Amazon Echo user?
I miss my Echo when I go on vacation.
Yeah, me too.
But I don't have the one with the screen. I just have the regular one, and it does everything I want. Because they were selling the show as a way to check the way you look in the morning when you dress. And since I just wear Tommy Bahama shirts every day, I don't need to check.
You're easy. You're easy.
That's a different one.
The Echo Show, this is CNBC. Todd Hazelden writes, the best smart home assistant you can buy. I mean, he says it's worth your money because... the screen really makes it much more usable. And I agree. I love it. Some people are complaining about the industrial design.
I think design looks okay.
That's okay. I got the white one. It looks good in the kitchen.
Scott, you're thinking of...
He's thinking about the Echo look.
Yes.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry.
That's not out yet, although I ordered that too, because I don't care if Amazon... I don't care if Jeff Bezos is looking at me. I want him to look at me. Look at me, Jeff!
You know, when they made the announcement that you could change the trigger word to computer so that, you know, in homage to the Star Trek episode, I did that. But the problem was
you say computer
the word computers on every TV show 15 times an hour.
No, by the way, we don't use the A word on the shows. Mm-hmm. I should have probably warned you, and you didn't. So that's good because most people have it set for the default.
Yeah.
And we don't want to trigger anybody's Echo. But the ones we use around here, we make it Echo. Mm. And that's pretty good. And when we talk about it, we refer to the Echo because I don't think many people have said it to the Echo. It reminds me so much of the Sony Dash or the Chumby. Or do you remember the, you go back far enough, Scott, you might remember Cisco had a thing called the Audrey, a kitchen computer.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Remember that?
That went the way of internet-connected fridges, though. I mean,
it didn't, but that's the difference is when you add the voice assistant, I feel like this is a really amazing thing.
Well, you see, well, I do kind of think of it as we're setting ourselves up for a little Terminator 3 action.
Well, you know? No kidding. I mean, I feel like Echo and Siri are having a conversation with the insurance companies and boards of directors of various companies and saying, this personnel problem that you have, we can solve that because personal assistants aren't going to harass anybody and they're not going to...
That's true.
All viruses on your computer.
That's true.
You know, get rid of this people problem you have and just happen.
Here's a picture from the Computer History Museum of the... it was 3Com, which was later acquired by Cisco, but the 3Com Audrey was a kitchen computer.
The 3Com also gave us the Palm Pilot, which was a fantastic product. You know, I mean, it was just... These kind of things come and go, but it just...
I think the Echo is a revolution.
You can do calls with your mother. I've got a phone that allows me to do that.
Yeah, but
well.
You have to pick it up. This way I can just say, drop in on mom. And she goes, what? She let me put on a robe. God. Sorry, mom.
I'm just getting slightly sick of all this. Every time I go to a restaurant or a bar, now my phone pings me and goes, oh, I see you're at such and such a bar. Would you like to leave a review for us? It's like, no, I'm here for a drink. Now,
I suppose at some point there may be a backlash. You're right. I mean, we may have gone too far. I don't know if you've noticed this, but Ian, but over your left shoulder is a camera. Of course, you're on camera right now, but that's the Nest IQ. And this camera is the newest indoor camera from Nest. It's a 4K camera.
Mm-hmm.
But it only sends 1080p. It looks at everybody, does face recognition.
Yeah.
And after a while, it says, oh, I haven't seen you in the house. I better let Leo know you're in the house. And it zooms in and follows you around.
Oh, no.
And it notifies me. But the negative, and the reason it's here and not at home, the negative is if until it learns who's who, it bugs you all the time. There's somebody in the house. There's somebody in the house. Somebody in the house. Somebody in the house. But I think eventually, we'll see, it learns all the people's faces and then it's...
Microsoft has applied for a patent for its Kinect platform, whereby... we already know...
Kinect recognizes you on my Xbox. When I walk in
Kinect
the room,
it
says hi,
Leo. Your heartbeat. It's,
that's right.
It's that, that's that accurate. But they've applied a patent for technology where if you're watching a film, Kinect will scan how many people in the room are there and work
you.
Out... And work out the charges based on the number of people that are there. And you're kind of like, what exactly is in this for the end user? I mean, I get that your take on this, but, you know, it's just, I fear that we're heading down a very slippery slope, and I intend to be a slight Luddite about it until it happens.
Look at this. This is from the chat room. It's called The Butler in a Box. High technology doesn't get any higher. From the minds of Master Voice, introducing Butler in a Box, the world's first environmental control system that responds to voice commands. This is 30 years ago.
Ah.
Wow.
The first with AIR, Artificial Intelligent Recognizer.
Oh,
a futuristic software program which makes it a reality. Is this a joke? 1985, tomorrow's dreams, today's reality.
I do remember the company Master Voice, so that's probably
this is real.
Wow.
Your butler in a box is smart enough to call you by name and answer intelligently with a variety of random responses. How intelligent is that?
Yeah.
In any language you wish, even with an accent.
I do think the company's missing.
There was a visionary Apple video where someone was interacting with their device and talking to it.
I own that video. I love that video. It had a guy, an assistant in a bow tie.
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah.
You remember Ask Jeeves? You know, it's just like sort of their idea. It's just, you know, okay.
So, can I interject something that relates to our earlier discussion?
Please.
And why? Yes. Hello. You can't change, as far as I know, from being a female voice.
No, right? Echo is always female. Right. Siri, you can make a man.
Yeah.
And I do. And my family gives me grief for it.
My Siri is a guy. Yeah. I like having a guy. I agree with you. It'd be nice.
I want celebrities to come out and record voices for this. I would pay some serious,
you could do that on Waze.
Serious money to have
Waze
will
let you have
Patrick Stewart as my Google Assistant voice. Yeah. It would just be, I'm there. Just take my money now.
That's just a matter of time.
Right. So I did some interesting tinkering around with Lucella last night, just in anticipation of the show.
Yeah.
And
call her Echo, Denise, please. Call her Echo or I'm going to hear from you, everybody.
Oh, sorry. Echo. One was prompted by the fact that listening to my kid and his friends chat with the virtual assistant, one of them told her, and this we're talking about Echo now, told her, "You're stupid," because she got a result wrong. And the response was, "That's not very nice."
Oh, so,
hey.
Right. So there's some sort of like corrective.
I like that.
Don't be such an a-hole. Yeah. Kind of.
I think
Lisa bought a book for her son called "Don't Be a Dick." We'll send you a copy.
Right.
It's etiquette for the modern age, and it's really, I think that's a good lesson.
Yeah.
Right.
No, so I mean, I think that whole...
Here, by the way, Denise, is the Knowledge Navigator review or a video that Apple made in 1986. This was their vision for the assistant of the future.
Its effects on rainfall in the sub-Sahara. It also covers droughts effect on...
That's the assistant.
...in Africa.
Oh, the brave new world we were facing back then.
Contact Jill.
I'm sorry, she's not available right now. I left a message that you had called.
Okay. Let's see.
This is the creepy
Where
professor using.
About 5 years ago, Dr. Flemson or something. He really disagreed with the direction of Jill's research.
John Fleming of Uppsala University.
You nitwit.
He published in the Journal of Earth Science of July 20 of 2006.
Yes, that's it. He was challenging Jill's projection of the amount of carbon dioxide
released
to the atmosphere.
1986. It's climate change this guy's researching. Figures.
Yes.
Here's the rate of deforestation he predicted.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. What happened?
So I don't think this is so far off, although it's ironic because Apple was 30 years ahead of its time. Maybe 40.
That looks like it was built on HyperCard, by the way.
It sure does, doesn't it? And it's Alan Kay's vision for a computer called the DynaBook, although Apple called it later the Knowledge Navigator. This was, I think... I'm trying to think if this was after Steve. I think this was a John Sculley production.
That would explain a lot.
Yeah.
So here's the experiment I did last night with Echo. We know that if you tell her she's stupid, she fights back.
Right.
Right.
If you tell her she's hot or she has a cute butt, she does not. She just throws up her hands and says, "I don't understand that. I can't respond."
Oh, I wish she would say. What should she say, Denise?
What did she say exactly?
She should say something like, "That's not a nice way to talk to somebody."
Yeah, she should. I mean, if she's telling you you're wrong to call her stupid, then she should call you on the rest of your
family. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good. I think that's just a matter of time. Let's.
I'd be tempted to be even more literal and say, "You think I've got a good butt? You think a good butt has portholes in the back?"
No, but I think that would be very useful to say. Not, "I don't have a butt," or "I am a machine."
No, just
but to say that's not a nice thing to say to somebody.
Mm.
That could really hurt their feelings. I think that would be
more blunt. Just say, "Do you kiss your mother with that mouth?" It's just like.
Yes, and doing that little tiny bit of research made me think forward to the fact that maybe. In our not too distant future, there will be personal assistants who are catered to people, and maybe some of these already exist, and I just don't know, to people who want to tell them that they have a cute butt or whatever.
Yeah. You
know, but one that's not just there to serve their shopping needs, but maybe other needs.
Well, you could build that into the software, certainly. It'd be a nice idea. I think backlash would be fairly swift, but
not necessarily. I think that's a good idea.
Frankly,
hey, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I live in a McMansion. I'm going to freely admit that. But we'll talk about
the legal case,
a new blog.
Oh, meet the Streisand effect. It was a lovely story.
But first, I want to thank the company that literally brings you this show every single day. It's Sonic, our 10 gigabit. Fiber internet service provider. I bet even Scott Bourne doesn't have 10 gigabits up and down. Sonic is not available, sorry to say, in Seattle, Scott, but it is available in San Francisco, the North Bay, and the East Bay area. And I've got to tell you, I know that this ad is frustrating for many of you because you can't get Sonic, but I want you to hear this because this is what is possible. This is a viable, successful, profitable company that gives you amazing internet for an amazing price. Listen to what you get if you're lucky enough to be able to get Sonic. And if you're in the Bay Area, you really ought to find out if you can. With Sonic, you get 15 email accounts, a gigabyte of storage, you get personal web hosting, you get a new domain, you get fax line service, you get a home phone with unlimited local and long-distance calling. You can port your existing number over to the home phone. Plus, you get gigabit internet service, $40 a month for all of that. And it's possible. And Sonic, by the way, no bandwidth caps. They will fight government subpoenas. They fight for your privacy.
Yep.
If you look on EFF, they're one of the few 4- or 5-star all green ISPs in the world because they really protect you. They've got great local customer support, affordable pricing, and their advocacy for you is paving the way for a better and, I think, more private internet across America. I love Sonic. I'm happy to be a Sonic customer here. I wish I were a Sonic customer at home. They don't have it in my area. If they do, get it. Join the internet revolution. Find out anyway at sonic.com/twit. Sonic.com/twit. You'll get your first month of Sonic internet and phone service free. And yes, they offer TV too. You can bundle it with Dish and save $120 on your Sonic bill. Sonic.com.
Now, I'm not Twitter. Part of the advertising thing here, but I've been using it for 8 years.
Oh, you're a Sonic customer?
I've been using it ever since I moved into my own place and got my own internet.
Do you have the gigabit?
No, I'm actually upgrading
Fusion,
at the moment.
Probably. Oh, yeah. But you can get it. You can get it now.
Yeah, I can get it now. But the key advantage for me is every time you pick up the phone for tech support, you get a human being instantly. There's no voicemail whatsoever, yeah. And it's just
And they're local. This is the 2016 EFF Who Has Your Back report. The Electronic Frontier Foundation does this, and if you look at, actually, this is not.
I've interviewed their CEO a couple of times for stories.
Dane is great. Dane Jasper. He's a friend.
He's a spot on bloke.
Yeah,
when it comes to net neutrality, they don't even keep their logs for 2 weeks. They don't filter. They don't cap. It's.
I thought Sonic was on this. Oh yeah, there you are.
Yeah,
5-star.
5 out of 5.
Follows industry accepted best practices. Tells users government data demands. Discloses policies on data retention. Discloses government content removal requests. Pro user public policy. And there aren't a lot of 5-star companies in here. Sonic is one of them, along with Apple and Dropbox.
I'm still amazed Apple got 5 stars, but still.
Well, I don't know if that's fair, but anyway. So this is one for Denise. Not because you live in a McMansion. I live in a McMansion. What do you know? What the definition of a McMansion is?
An enormous, tasteless house. No. Yeah. I'm teasing.
Basically,
you have large, pre-designed houses which you can just plop down onto the land where you've got it.
They tend to be extravagant. They're kind of show-offy. But the blog, which I love, McMansionHell.com. McMansion. Do you know about this McMansion? They have been. Not recently. In fact, if you go there now, you'll see a lot of public domain images. But what they had been doing is taking images off of Zillow. Let me if I scroll down far enough, maybe I can find it. And basically doing a critique of the house, of how bad the house is.
Yeah.
It's all of those are gone because Zillow complained. They said you can't use these.
And now millions of people who had never heard of this blog at all, and I was like, I got to get me some of that. You know?
Good, the good news is Zillow has decided not to pursue a legal action. Kate Wagner, who authors the blog, got good news, EFF, to defend her and threatened Zillow with a potential countersuit. She says it's fair use of Zillow's images. The photos showing the exterior and interior of huge, ugly suburban homes are used to skewer the celebration of wealth and conspicuous consumption. That's fair use, isn't it, Denise?
Well, this is not just a story for me, but for Scott. These are not Zillow's images. The images are uploaded by third parties.
Oh. They don't even own them.
Yeah, that's the problem.
So Zillow's asserting ownership of pictures that somebody else took.
Cheeky buggers.
So...
The thing is, if you're critiquing the photos, then that would probably be fair use.
Yeah.
But if you're critiquing the house, I don't think so.
No, they're critiquing the house, not the photos. So they're using the photos to say, oh, look at this ridiculous house. And
but Zillow doesn't have the standing here. Zillow doesn't own the copyright in these photos.
The photographer does.
The photographer probably, in most cases, is a real estate agent who put the listing up on the real estate.
I think probably Zillow knew that and just decided, well, this is a blog no one's ever heard of. We'll fire off a legal letter to them, and then, you know, they'll shut up, and we can get back on with our lives. And then Streisand effect kicks in, and the world and its dog knows about this site now, and we're all going on there trying to find out what is going on. It's great.
I hope Kate puts those original pictures back up in the original post. It looks like, to protect herself, she took them down. She only has public domain images on there right now.
As Scott points out, though, I mean, I'm not sure, you know, house photo. If you're commenting on the subject matter of the picture, you may well have a good fair use argument too. So there are probably two reasons why these should stay. No right of Zillow to assert this claim, and they're doing commentary on
the
photos.
Right. And the photographer probably doesn't complain because it's a real estate agent who wanted to sell the house in the first place. The more publicity for the house, the better. Well, maybe not this kind of publicity.
new, not something they want their name associated with.
My house would fit right in. I absolutely live in a McMansion. I'm the first to admit it. So Uber just completed its 5 billionth trip.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you think it'll get to 6 billion?
Oh, easily, yes. Yeah. They've got 7 billion in VC cash to burn through.
It's an example of
subsidized taxes.
Bad publicity isn't necessarily bad.
Well, I mean, Lyft is...
missing a C-suite right now?
Say again?
Aren't they kind of missing a C-suite?
Yeah. Like nobody. Everybody's either fired or gone. Including Travis Kalanick, the founder.
Yeah, Marissa Mayer seems to be positioning herself to take
it. Is she?
Well, did you not hear her comments earlier on the Twitter? Oh, she went off on this screen about how I don't think this is Travis's fault. The company grew so fast, he probably didn't know what was going on. It's like, you're auditioning for the CEO job, aren't you?
OMG. Well, yeah. I would think Uber would hire a woman. I think that would be one way to kind of help reinvent the company's culture.
Yeah, but it's got to be a woman with the kind of gumption that's needed to do a root and branch reform of that organization. Yeah. And I don't know, Sheryl Sandberg could do it in a heartbeat.
COO at Facebook, but would she take it?
I know, this is the problem. I don't think that she would. I don't personally think she would either. But you just need, man or woman, you need someone to really take that organization and shake it up by the scruff of the back of the neck.
6 months after The Guardian said WhatsApp had a backdoor, they finally admitted, by the way,
mealy-mouthed.
This is an opinion piece, not even a retraction.
But they were like, a lot of people objected to this article because it was in The Guardian. It's like, no, we objected to it because it was wrong and it's putting people's lives at risk.
To steal a phrase from you, bollocks.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Turkish government took copies of that article and put them out on state media as a
hoping
way of discouraging people from going onto an encrypted messaging service.
Right.
I mean, I was at a security conference just after that story broke, and one guy who I respect and isn't prone to hyperbole said whoever wrote that and whoever edited it and published it has got blood on their hands.
Yeah. 72 security experts shortly after the article was published wrote an open letter saying, absolutely, WhatsApp is secure. The problem you're talking about is not a significant issue. Mm. Can be changed in the settings.
Easy as pie.
And The Guardian finally, 6 months later, said, well, our reporting was flawed.
Nobody ever likes to say that, but as a journalist, you've got a responsibility to get that out there as soon as
possible. Yeah.
And
you're right. This is more serious than just getting it wrong. The risk is that somebody, a dissident who needs privacy, might not use WhatsApp and go to something less secure or less widely used because they're afraid of, you know, that WhatsApp has been cracked. All right, I think we can wrap things up here. I appreciate Denise putting up with all of the technical issues. You're a trooper, Denise.
I appreciate you putting up with all the technical issues. I thought I had them ironed out, but
we'll do anything to get you on. I think you're the greatest, and I think everybody should watch This Week in Law. You can watch back episodes at twit.tv/twil, and there's quite a few. You've done 392 episodes. Wow.
And our last
good Lord.
Was Simon Tam of the Slants case.
Whoa, that's great.
Short. you should watch this episode. This is one of our episodes that I'm most happy and proud of.
The episode that shall not be named.
Tune in Fridays, 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific, and 1800 UTC.
Yes.
Wow. Simon Tam of the Slants. Wow.
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
I'm too much of a Firefly fan. I heard Simon Tam, and I thought, really? You're defending it?
This week in law. Thank you for being here, Denise, on your vacation.
Thank you. Last plug. If you want to watch a great series of videos about what is harassment and what is not, David Schwimmer did one back in April of this year called That's Harassment. So just Google That's Harassment on YouTube and you'll see this wonderful series of videos.
Yeah.
And it's very much in keeping with Reid Hoffman's vision that people will just decide to educate themselves and be better.
We should point out that David Schwimmer produced it and stars in it, but it was written by a woman, Segal Avin.
I'd also like to highlight the British police have done a whole thing on what is consent, and the way they've figured it is it's working through various scenarios in Would You Like a Cup of Tea? And if you just search British police tea consent, you should be able to get that.
Yeah.
Good.
Excellent.
Good. And that's great, Denise. Thank you for mentioning that. David Schwimmer, of course, the former star of Friends, I believe, if I'm not wrong. Mm-hmm. Is it on Facebook? Is that where the video is on? They have a Facebook page called That's Harassment. I guess that'd be the best place to...
They're all available. I think if you just Google it, you'll find it on any number of platforms.
Okay, good. Or follow the Facebook page. That's a great idea. Scott Bourne, it's been so great to reconnect with you, one of our original TWIT cast members on MacBreak Weekly way back in 2007.
Yeah, it's been an honor to be on the show, Leo, and an honor to be with all of you.
I'm so glad things are going well for you. Everybody should follow Scott on his blog, scottbourne.com. I follow him on Facebook, which is awesome because I get to see all his really nice pictures. Is your Facebook page public, or is that just because I'm a friend?
Yeah, I got this. I'm Scott Bourne on Twitter, Scott Bourne on Facebook, Scott Bourne on LinkedIn, but I'm Bourne Scott on Instagram.
Go figure. B-O-U-R-N-E. He spells it properly.
Like the Bourne identity.
Yeah, uh-huh. Like Ian spells his name properly. Without a P and with some weird I-A-N thing.
Yeah, trust me, my parents and I have had words on that one.
Thank you, Scott. It's so great to see you. And thank you for all the beautiful images. Man, your stuff is so good.
And you got a standing invitation to come up to last with me anytime you want.
I would love to. And then you know we have the fire cranes picture hanging in Lisa. Lisa stole it, but she's got it in her office. And
cranes in the fire mist.
Cranes in the fire mist. I look at that every day and I think, gosh.
Well, thank you for hanging it.
Great picture. Yeah, you can buy your pictures on your site, can't you?
Yeah. Not that one. It's sold out.
Oh, really? So you do limited editions.
I do limited editions, yeah.
Yeah, as you properly should. Cranes in the Fire Mist was I feel very fortunate.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, then to have it. Go look at it in Lisa's office.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a beautiful print. Ian Thompson is at the Register, register.co.uk, comes by often, and I'm glad you do. I hope you will continue to, even though the British store closed, and so you can't get your...
Yeah, although there is a good British pub on the way here, which serves sausage rolls and cask beer. It's in San Rafael.
Oh, what's it called?
I can't remember, but Megan recommended it to me.
Nice.
And as it's Brexit 1776 weekend, then I'm going to go down and enjoy a pint. So
you said you have mixed feelings about celebrating Independence Day since it was the day that we kicked you guys out.
Yeah, I know. But at the same time, four-day weekend, you guys got Trump. So, you know, it's just I'm ahead on the game here. You know?
We do This Week in Tech every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. That would be 2200 UTC. If you want to stop by and say hi, please join us in the chat room. If you do, we can talk at each other then. irc.twit.tv. If you can't be here during the live show, I understand there are things to do. We make on-demand versions of everything we do available on our website, twit.tv, and on YouTube. And of course, you can subscribe. If you have a favorite way to listen to podcasts, make sure you look for Twit in there and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Because we wouldn't want you to miss one. We like having you here. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Another twit.
This is amazing.
Bye-bye.